Just a few film nerds breaking out of a rut, drooling over cinemas.
Max and Cassandra, manic pixie dream girls. This week we're chatting Elizabeth Town. What's with the hate, you cynical critics? The movie's pretty funny. The
I'm all hopped up on Mountain Dew. No, I'm kidding. It's still chocolate-covered espresso beans. I recorded this basically immediately after I finished cutting the previous half of this episode. Speaking of which, you are listening to part two of me and Cassandra's discussion of 2005's Elizabeth Town as part of our Manic Pixie Dream Girl series. If you missed part one of this episode, it should immediately precede this in whatever podcast catcher you're listening to this episode on. Go back and listen to that, then come on back over and listen to this, where we are about to start talking about Rusty's Learning to Listen, Part 8.
Okay, can we talk about Rusty's Learning to Listen, Part 8? Yeah. That is maybe one of the fucking funniest little, like, weird cameo asides I've ever seen in my life. There's this little shithead kid, listener, for those of you who haven't seen Elizabeth Town. I'm sure many of you haven't because you've read the reviews and you're like, pass. But there's this little kid named Samson. Samson screaming was pretty irritating, but it's meant to be. So he's just a total shit, screaming. He throws a ham on the floor and the dogs like fight over it. And then he gets into a car, turns it on, and rolls into the street. Orlando Bloom like saves him, and then he kind of becomes the catalyst for Jesse and his father. You know, his father, you can't be buddies with your son, and you see Jesse's like very hurt by that. But this kid Samson is just a fucking holy terror, and Claire has a friend. Once again, I don't know if people are reading this as like, oh, it's so quirky, she had this tape. No, she has a friend who's a parent who had a piece of shit kid, and this tape fixed that problem. So she's passing that on to a friend of hers. Oh, you've got this problem? I have a friend who can help. The tape is nuts, though. So she gives Drew this cassette tape, and all these kids are going crazy as they're planning the funeral. So Drew goes into the other room with the tape, gives it to he walks over to Samson and goes, "Hey, buddy, we're gonna watch this." Pops the tape in. The kids are like, ah! A truck drives up in front of a house, a like quaint little like house on the prairie, kind of yellow house in the middle of a field. Door opens, a big work boot comes out, and when that door slams, the everything about this video is perfect. The sound design, the casting of Jim Fitzpatrick, the costuming, Fitzpatrick's performance. Like, he is so dead earnest when he's talking, you know, on the tape to these little kids. I actually watched that part of the movie 3 times.
It feels so real. It feels so real to me. I'm like, this is totally something my ADHD son would sit down and watch. Yes.
When the door slams and they cut to his face with the like construction worker helmet on, every kid in the room just shuts up and they're looking slack jawed in awe at the screen. Like, oh. And he goes, "Hi. My name's Rusty. Many years ago, I helped build this house. But an infestation of insects called termites have compromised this fine structure. So today, I'm going to blow it up." So they cut to inside and they're like literally wiring the house with plastic explosives, and Rusty's standing there. There's no way to describe this if you haven't seen it with your eyes. You have to watch this, at least this part. I'm sure it's on YouTube. He looks at the kids and he goes, "Now, if I blow this house up, do you promise to be good and mind your mommies and daddies?" And all the little kids are like, yes, yes, you know, talking to the screen. They all affirm it. Then they walk out. And he goes, all right, gets out there, gets on the plunger. He gets on his, it's so funny, man. He gets on his radio and he's like, we good to go? Light her up, Jim. 3, 2, the little kids are all freaking out, covering their eyes and shit. And when he almost reminds me of Bruce Campbell in like Evil Dead. He looks right at the camera and goes, 1. J-j-j-. And then they do the triple play of him just fucking blowing this house. It's Rambo 2 level explosion, man. This shit is splinters when he's done. And his like, whoa! It's like wild man scream. I was like, fuck yeah. I can't wait to call my mom and be like, I'm sorry. You should have just shown this to me and Sam. But then at the end, he turns to the camera and goes, and he's like still got some adrenaline going from just blowing a house up. And he goes, now, let's build a new house.
Yeah.
And that's like the end of the video, right? But here's what I wrote down. Not only is that funny as fuck, that is hysterically funny. That is also a perfect metaphor for Drew's life. And also kind of just for life in general. You know what I mean? Even down to the purpose of the video, which is like, you've got this beautiful house, right? But it's been compromised. It's been eaten and infested. And Drew's like, you know, he's not in a good spot. We're going to demolish this. And you're going to refocus on your family, okay? And after that's done, with family in mind, we're going to build a new structure together. And it's a fucking hysterical little children's videotape, and it's like a microcosm of the film, the whole like theme of the film inside the film. It's great.
It's such a bizarre little moment, and it feels so real, too. Because, I mean, like, BattleBots, my kids are into anything crazy.
BattleBots is awesome.
My brother does like announcements for BattleBots.
No shit.
He's really into it. Yeah, he's really into it, and his kids love it too, and it's super fun. But I love the relationship with Jesse and his son in this movie too, because it's like we learn that Drew and his dad weren't really that close, and that's kind of interesting. But then just seeing like Jesse's relationship with his young son and then his dad and how different they are and them kind of like awkwardly working it out on screen. It feels so real and emotional and raw, and I love it.
Yeah, definitely. It affected me watching the end of the movie with Drew driving with the urn in the passenger seat. And near the end of the road trip, he starts talking to the urn. He's talking to he's talking to his dad. You know, and you see him laugh, you see him get angry, you know, as he's talking about Phil, that bastard Phil, you know, oh, and you, daddy, I had all these good ideas, but people just weren't ready or whatever, you know. And then you see him cry, you see him grieve. He goes on a road trip with his dad, a long overdue road trip. It even says, and that's like, oh my God. Like, that was one of the lines that got me near the end, is as you go through this kind of montage, obviously impeccably scored, cool soundtrack, he turns and looks at the urn and the buckled up, you know, looks at the urn and then looks back out the front window and he goes, we should have done this years ago. And that's such a great line. It's so bittersweet because it's still in character, you know, like something you would say if you're father was sitting next to you in a car and you were on a road trip and why did we put this off? We should have done this years ago. And also the poignancy of, and now we can't, you know, we aren't, you're gone. We should have done this. I should have done this years ago. Like facing and recognizing and regretting is what he's done. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no. And I also like how, like, when he's with his cousin too, his cousin's kind of like, yeah, I don't know my dad that well either. And I was kind of laugh about it because it's like, yeah, his dad's here, but he still doesn't get along with him. And right. That's so realistic too.
I like Clay's. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No, I just love that. And I love seeing like how hard it is for, I don't know. I just feel like that's such a relatable character for me, the Jesse Baylor character, like Drew's cousin, because it's like your parents wanted the best for you and they're good parents, but the way you're raising your kids is not the same as they raised you. And they're like, you can't be friends with your kids. And it's like, we love different, you know, like everything's important in this household.
Abraham
music.
Lincoln and Ronnie Van Zant.
Exactly. Like culture. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I really like his character.
He's got this great line where they're walking home from like the planning the funeral right after they watch that videotape. And his cousin's like, yeah, it's hotter than hell down here, but we've got stars.
Yeah, hotter than the hinges of hell. I like that. Yeah. Line. I like that line too. That's real good. Yeah, it gets hotter than the hinges of hell down here. But
it's just one of those lines that reminds you, like if you're from the city, it doesn't. But like if you're from the country or anywhere remote or like you've spent a lot of time outside, I don't know, it just reminds you me of like going home. It's like, yeah, like it's crazy because you can always go back to that like simpler time.
Yeah.
You know, the heat of the summer and just the sky. And
it does evoke a strong sense of place, this movie. Mm-hmm. In a really excellent way. It really Elizabethtown feels, it kind of almost reminds me of the town in Lars and the Real Girl. It feels like a lived in place. It doesn't just feel like a setting, you know, it feels like stuff's going on in those buildings they're walking through the streets.
And like you said with the tape, like there's that one aside, but then there's also the wedding of Chuck and Cindy.
Oh, I know. Like another.
What? I love that as well.
Love and life 24/7.
I wanted to hate Chuck so much, but I love Chuck.
Dude, you're so sketched. Like when he steals beers out of what are they in? It's like beer. The bathtub is full of ice and there's like Stella Artois, and Drew goes in and steals a couple beers while he's on the phone with Claire. He's like, I am currently stealing beers from Chuck and Cindy's wedding. And he turns around and he goes, and Chuck, there's a guy standing in the hallway, and he goes, you're one of Chuck's friends, aren't you? And he goes, yes. And he goes, no, you ain't. I'm Chuck. I know, like you're like, oh, this is gonna suck. And I love the reversal of how that scene goes, because Drew's just honest with him. Rather than try and come up with some BS whatever, he's like, yeah, I'm your neighbor. I'm not here for the wedding. I'm here for a funeral. My dad died. And then Chuck, life and death side by side. But every time they hug, the bottles in their pockets clink together.
But what he's saying is so true, though. It is a trip.
It's like
it's a cycle of life. It's fucked up. Life and death right next to each other.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
People getting married. People getting married, and a new chapter's beginning as another chapter ends. You know.
I also love the scene where he realizes that. There's like this huge fight over his dad being buried or cremated. And finally they decide he's going to be cremated. And he wakes up in the middle of the night like, oh no. And he tries to go and stop the cremation, but it's too late. And I remember having dreams when I was little of like being cremated, mm-hmm. and nightmares, and it really freaking me out, and telling my mom when I was like 10, like, make sure if I die that you bury me, don't cremate me. This is gonna I really don't want to be burned. And she's like, why are you telling this to me? Like, what is wrong with you?
Old. Jesus Christ.
I was like, I had seen My Girl, you know, I'm like, this is what I want to be buried with. And
that scene is actually my next note. It's after the wake has all been planned and such, but before like the memorial service.
Mm-hmm.
So they go to, they're all just standing around in the kitchen. And actually that's a really cool scene too, because they're all standing in the kitchen, just kind of like, there's an, there's a touch of like melancholy in the air, but they're all, it's wry. They're all sitting there kind of wryly smiling with just a little hint of melancholy swirling through the room. And they're all, you can tell that they're all individually remembering Mitch. You know, they all kind of feel him there with them. And Paula Deen is, I think, boiling water or making soup, and she takes a pot off the stove, and Orlando Bloom looks and he sees the flame, the gas flame. And in that moment, it clicks for him why these people don't want him to be cremated.
Mm-hmm.
So he runs down to the crematorium. This scene got me too, because he runs down and he's pounding on the door and he's screaming, "Stop the cremation, stop the cremation." And the crematory assistant like opens the door and he's like, come on, get in. And he runs downstairs like to try and stop it. But when he comes back up, the cremation had happened hours ago and the remains are already in the urn. And his line is, the line is fucking crazy. Like in Garden State, this moment would be played for laughs.
Mm-hmm.
In this movie, it stabs you in the heart. This guy holds the urn out very respectfully, and he looks so, there. I don't even know, crestfallen is not the right word. He's devastated that he wasn't able to stop this, that this is where he's standing right now, and that he's got to deliver this, and he hands this urn to Drew and he goes, "Sorry. Here's your dad, man." In Garden State, there'd be almost like a laugh track behind that, but it's just so straight. "Here's your dad, man." What a fucking crazy line. I loved that. I thought that was so powerful.
Yeah. And then you're wondering, like, does he think he just messed up again? Like, he just failed his dad again, you know?
Right. Like, the impact on Drew is, and that's the other reason that I love the road trip at the end, is Claire. Partly it's like Claire gives him a chance not only to like make things right with his dad, but to forgive himself too. Even for the shoe thing, like she gives him like time. She's like, "Look, yeah, this hurts and sucks and you need to wallow. Everybody, when something goes this wrong, you got to take a second and feel bad for yourself." But by that tight timeline doesn't allow him to stay in that spot. She kind of teaches him how to like move through stuff. We could all use more help with that, man. Claire has a great line shortly after this when Drew comes down and he's sitting on the couch when they're all trying to get Claire to come to the Maker's Mark distillery tour the next day. And she sits down and they're talking and he's mostly talking about himself. So she goes, "The personnel interview went really well," and reminds him of something about her, which is another thing about this, which is like so anti-Manic Pixie Dream Girl. She calls this guy on his bullshit. Like, "Okay, look, I'm taking a lot of interest in like stuff that you're telling me. I've told you some things about myself as well, and you're not listening very well." And he turns, because he's like, "You look fabulous in that dress. You look so beautiful. Oh, you're incredible. You're one in a million." He's giving her all these compliments, which she calls ice cream cones. And she goes, you know, she brings up the personnel interview and he goes, "Oh, I'd forgotten all about that." And she goes, "I'm impossible to forget, but I'm hard to remember." It's like this very gentle chiding, you know, that is literally, if you apply that line, if you give that, like, that's almost like a Ramona Flowers line. That's all but, "I'm not your manic pixie dream girl." You know what I mean? "Oh yeah, I'm impossible to forget, but I'm hard to remember. You know, you like the dress, but you don't remember anything about me. You just, you
yeah,
know." It's, God, it's
it definitely so cool. Has like a fuck you element to it.
But not a, and yeah, yeah, it's a, but it's a gentle fuck you. This movie really is kind of, this is very soft around the edges. It really is like a warm, fuzzy kind of, even the really sad stuff does kind of temper itself a little bit. But like you said, that's why it makes such a good rainy day feeling blue kind of flick, is this movie's not going to punish you or hurt you too bad, you know, and it'll reward you in the end, definitely. I like that they forgot the urn in the ballroom. Actually, I kind of like that whole scene where she is like, she's a little drunk. Like, again, Reed's real. That's not her being quirky. That's how you act when you're drunk.
Yeah. She's like, and I haven't eaten for a week. I want Coca-Cola.
And cheese.
Cheese. I'm like, accurate. Very accurate.
Oh, man. We already talked a little bit about, because they hook up that night. There's another great line right there when she's saying, like, she keeps bringing up Ben. Ben is kind of her, like,
right,
way to deflect unwanted attention. So they end up kissing, and Drew says, Ben is very lucky that all we did tonight is kiss. And she has a line that says, most of the sex I've had in my life is not as personal as that kiss.
Right.
Which, even better, she gives her like some sexual agency. It shows that she's not like some innocent wallflower virgin. You know, this is a person with a life, lived experience, a past, a future. Like, she's got plans. This is not like some weird ephemeral flitting fairy like creature. This is it's a cool human being you bumped into. Man, I'm going to remember how you said that earlier for like the rest of time. Women can't be interesting or smart. They have to be angels instead.
It's weird how Ebert wrote this entire article years later talking about, oh, it must be that she's an angel and because of this and this.
60D, like, he's like, that's code for God. So she came down from heaven. That's her trip to Hawaii, was her going back to heaven. He came up with an entire like secret movie inside the movie, almost as a way to like make him not embarrassed to like it. Yeah, to justify like the quality, some quality of this film. That's fucked up.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's really bizarre.
It's a lot of mental gymnastics to just be like, this was a cool movie. I liked it.
And it's more we dig into like the manic pixie dream girl thing, it's like they say it like it's negative, like it's a bad thing, like, oh, it's a bad trope. But I don't think it is necessarily a bad trope, or I don't know. It's just the more I find about it online and the more I learn about it, it says more about, I guess, I know that it's men that are writing these tropes, but I think it's like the people interpreting it, even, it's saying more about than the men that are writing it, because I don't think that this really says anything about how Russell Crowe like sees women, or
Cameron Crowe.
yeah sees women or anything like that. And it's, I don't know, like, I get it that there is this toxic need of like agreeing with everything a guy says and like being quirky for the sake of being quirky, and then you're like solving all their problems and then they disappear, or you disappear, you know. But also, like, can girls not have personalities? Like,
but that I think as we dig into this, I'm becoming more and more convinced that the manic pixie dream girl is a toxic film trope. My argument in this film is that Claire is not a manic pixie dream girl. Claire is a fully rounded, compassionate, intelligent, well-traveled, thoughtful, active listening romantic. She reads like a real person to me in a lot of ways. I think Natalie Portman, and I think you're right too. I think this trope is not about women. This trope is about men and how men perceive fantasy versions, very hollow, shallow, surface level fantasy versions of women. I think what the Natalie Portman character in Garden State is offensive to me in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
from a feminist perspective. Zero agency. She has no real depth. She has no real desires. She kind of just exists to truly to like help Zach Braff get back on his feet And then when he literally discards her like we talked about it in the episode, but he discards her like trash to go back to his to go and find himself and his career, then decides that he wants to pick her back out of the trash. And she's cool with that after just having been thrown away. She's like, oh, he came back. It's clearly abuse. It's like, not even borderline. It's just like it's like textual, psychological and emotional abuse. And it's portrayed as like, she's just this quirky, whimsical girl. I think that's damaging. I think what we see kind of next time, the next film is one of my favorites of all time. I love Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And I'm excited to dig into it from this perspective, because the last time I talked about this movie on my show, we just did like it as a film. A lot of the writing is beautiful. The structure's amazing. The cinematography is incredible. It's one of Jim Carrey's best performances. But I've forgotten her name. Kate Winslet.
Oh, Kate Winslet. Yeah.
Kate Winslet's character is hard to sit with and irritating a lot of the time.
I can't stand that movie because of her.
I know. When I watched Garden State, I was like, some parts of this are good, but every time Natalie Portman pops up, I'm like, ah, oh, God. And Eternal Sunshine, I think, could be great. I mean, it is. I think Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is a great movie with a massive flaw. It's got a real big sliver in its foot. You know what I mean? If that part were fixed, it would be a totally different thing. She's just not a real. And the problem is, she's not a real person. She's like an idea of a person to serve an agenda. And that just doesn't ring true. It rings hollow. It's false. It's almost like an uncanny valley experience. You like look and you try and figure out where what this person is. You know, like, okay, well, what was her childhood like? And you just can't figure anything out because it's just a collection of weird, literally in that case, quirks. This, like I said, it's not quirks, it's eccentricities. And I would argue it's not even eccentricities.
It's just her personality.
Yeah, she just has a personality. Like, I don't know if critics just don't know interesting people. Do you just know like boring fucking egotistical narcissists? Because I know a bunch of people like this, you know, like maybe not quite, not the beginning. The beginning is a little bumpy. But once you get into the meat of the movie, I know plenty of people who kind of behave this way.
Yeah, and they end up together, so I wonder why it's not like rom-com, you know?
And they end up together because of her. She draws him a map. Dude, she draws him a map. Again, like...
And he has to choose to go there, too. You know, she's like, if you want to, you can come here.
Yeah, she gives him a choice. Like, there's two ways you could go. You can find the girl in the red hat, and I have some other ideas. Or you can go back and the rest of the map will take you home. So that's cool too. She doesn't like it wasn't just a map that leads him to her and she's like, and I can't live without you. She gives him agency. Look,
yeah,
you do what you want, but you know what, man? I am interested in you. So I will, if you want to explore this with me, follow the right road, you know, or you could take the left road and go back home and the ball's in your court. The other thing I like about that road trip is, he's gone through this trauma and is fucked up, and he doesn't have as much life experience as she does. Not as well traveled. He just hasn't lived like she has. He's lived in this weird little shoe company bubble in California, you know? She's lived an actual full life. So not in like a patronizing way or a shitty way or even a quirky way. She goes... He needs to process. He needs to get in touch with his emotions. He needs to process his grief. He needs to overcome this weird shame that he feels about his failure. And he needs to rediscover the beauty of the natural world and of real life.
And America.
Exactly. He needs to go find himself.
And the movie does that, right? Without being patronizing. Like, I feel like when those scenes, when you go back to the town, when you're in the town, they all feel good and genuine and saccharine. They don't feel like the movie's talking down to you. And then, because there is a point in this movie that where you're visiting the place where Martin Luther King was killed, you're visiting the survivor tree, and like, this could suddenly turn into a very like self-righteous movie that you
but
don't
you also
watch.
Get the metal dinosaur with a fish in its mouth. It's,
but it's all good. Like, it all plays really well.
I totally agree. Honestly, the Martin Luther King bit, like, it has gravitas to it. It stops you in your tracks, you know? Like, and it's such a contrast. Her showing him, bringing him to the place where Martin Luther King died, as opposed to the two Norman Rockwells that were hanging outside of John F. Kennedy's, you know, and John F. Kennedy got assassinated or whatever. That's just, that guy's just really rich. So he has those up as like decorations. She takes him to the physical place where a momentous historic event happened, you know, like.
And she says his failure was only just the beginning of his success.
His death.
His death.
His
yeah.
Death it, was right. only the beginning, just the beginning of his success. And like that helps right there. She's kind of like alluding to the fact that, yes, he's lost his father, but the end of your father's life could be the beginning of yours. If you can just get through this moment and feel everything and come back alive. It doesn't feel like Zach Braff just needed a wacky friend to go have adventures with so he could remember how fun it was to be a little kid. It's like somebody who's further along in their emotional development sees what you need and has just enough cool eccentricity in them and just enough. Or, this is an artist, man. This is not a manic pixie dream girl. This is like someone who shouldn't have been a flight attendant. They should have been a painter, or they should have been like a multimedia collage artist or a filmmaker, you know, like that's all that is. That's an emotionally well-balanced and centered person helping somebody who's suffering do the emotional work necessary so that when the time comes to either choose a career or a relationship, they're in the right headspace to make that decision. It's such a fucking healthy ending. Like, what an amazing way to do it. And like, are people bummed that she helped him? Well, she just existed to like help him get over his grief. Like, we should all be doing that. Like, my grandma just died a few years ago and I've been really struggling with it. Hey man, why don't we get coffee? Let's talk. I've been missing my uncle a lot lately, you know, like we used to have such great conversations about these books. What books did he like? Yeah. Oh, I've read that one too. Let's talk. We need to help each other more. And these fucking cynical asshole reviewers, I think that's what it is. I honestly do. I think the people watch this movie and they're just like, oh, I don't know what it is. There, like, there's a hardening of the heart or something, because this movie just it brought out a lot of like warm feelings of like love and hope in me. I really dug the shit out of it.
I loved it. I love it so much. And
it beats Garden State cold. Garden State is trash compared to Elizabethtown. This movie's so much better than that one. It's unbelievable. Right.
Well, and then like, yeah, there's that scene where he's like in the Hall of Trees in Arkansas and he's like dancing alone. And it's funny because whenever they filmed that, a ton of people knew that they were filming and showed up to watch. And so he's like trying to get in his head and pretend like he's alone. He's doing it in front of all these people. Right, like, but I love it. He pulls it off.
Yeah, but it's funny. He was Bird walks through as that scene was happening and she goes, yeah, that is a white boy dancing. And I was like, but I think that's the point, though, is like there's a way that you move when you're in your body and you're just feeling, you know, you're just feeling yourself and you're just moving to feel good. I think that's why people stop dancing as they get older. Yeah. Is there like so many people are like, oh, you can't fucking dance. And you're like, maybe it's not about like I learned all of these moves and practiced them endlessly. Maybe it's like it feels so good to like move your body around. And that absent judgment is beautiful. It's a cool thing to see. I like that scene too. That's great. I literally think one of the funniest scenes I've ever seen in my life is Ruckus playing Freebird while that eagle lights the banner on fire and then comes back, crashes to the floor, and Jesse they all look at him and Jesse goes, just keep playing. And Bird asked me, she's like why wouldn't they stop, you know, like if water's pouring down, their gear's all getting ruined. I'm like, two reasons. One, they came out there to play this song for Mitch. So, like, dude, that is the most rock and roll thing I've ever seen. They literally, the room is on fire and water is spraying down. Nothing on earth could stop me from playing in that moment. This is your moment. Dude, you get one shot at something like this, and these boys are in it, and they're doing it for Mitch, but they're also doing it for them, because there's that great moment earlier where he's like, we almost played for Skynyrd, you know, and they go down the list, and Ruckus also featuring Ruckus or whatever, and then he goes, we didn't play, and we never played again.
But never played since.
Haven't played since.
They're reuniting for one night only.
Yeah, to play this one song.
I love it.
But they know too. That's why they don't stop, is they're killing it. They're like, yeah, this was it, dude. This is what it always should have been, and it'll never be again. But right fucking now, we're gonna do this. Man, I was like, this is ridiculous. We're talking about Elizabethtown, and I have like the hairs are standing up. I've got goosebumps. I fucking love that scene so much.
And I don't know, maybe people think it's like a stereotype that they would be playing Freebird. It's not. Like, this happens. This is definitely being played at every like big jam thing you might go to, whether it be like a memorial service or like a football game or a high school party, like a graduation party. Like, they're going to play Freebird. I wasn't sure
about funeral, but this is a South thing.
Definitely a Southern thing.
If you go down far enough south, man, Skynyrd turns into a different kind of band.
Exactly.
I just don't think people. Yeah, go and hang out in the South sometimes. It's getting honestly.
Don't turn it off. Like, I wouldn't actually listen to it on my own, but if it's on the radio, you know not to turn it off.
Oh yeah, definitely. So I have one of the I've accrued a lot of weird pieces of like musical gear throughout my life in weird ways. When I was a kid, I was in a like this high school punk rock band and we thought we were so fucking cool. But we were in this tiny town called Detour Village that had 400 people in it. And we were right on the marina out near the St. Mary's River in like up between the border of Michigan and Canada. And for whatever reason, really excellent, like, just touring bands would come and play the marina. They'd just like set up on this big outdoor pavilion and play a show to like 100 people. And then the next night they would go downstate, you know, or go to Marquette and then head downstate and end up playing like Ann Arbor or Chicago. And one night these guys came through and I was in high school still. So they like started the show. I had to go home, do my chores, eat dinner. And then me and my brother would rush back to town in my car to catch the end of the marina show. We showed up and this band was doing exactly this. They were so just ripping through Freebird by Lynyrd Skynyrd. Just outrageous, like smoking guitar strings. It was unbelievable. And, you know, the crowd's going, swinging crazy. And it was their closing song. It was the only song we caught was Freebird by Skynyrd. And it would have been a request. Everybody, this is a musician thing too. You're playing a set and then people start yelling Freebird at you. Like, it's almost a joke until you're in the right. South and then it's not. But
yeah,
the next
exactly play the hits.
The next day, that guy was, my high school girlfriend at the time. Her family owned a bunch of cabins that you could rent on the lake that I lived on when I was a kid. And I went over to visit her, and that guy was there with his band. They were just like jamming in one of the cabins, and they were going to pack up later that night and leave. So me and my brother went over and we're like, you guys were fucking awesome last night. You were so good. And he was like, yeah, well, we've been on stage. Well, he and one other guy, because they were just session musicians. He's like, we've been on stage with Skynyrd, so we always play that as the closer, like as an homage. And I was like, no fucking shit. And on their way out of town that night, the dude, we were just still hanging out with him, and they're like, we got to start packing up. And he turned off his amplifier, and he gave my brother gave it to me now because it's so big and he doesn't have space for it, but he gave my brother a 1968 PV bass cabinet, 2x20 bass cabinet. It's so fucking awesome. It's this huge bass cab, beat as hell. You can tell it's been dragged all over the country. It's got a big American flag sticker peeling off the side of it, duct tape and foam around the handles, and it sounds like no other speaker cabinet I've ever heard. And he's like, I'm just sick as hell of carrying this thing around. It weighs like 100 pounds. He's like, I hate dragging this thing around. Do you guys want this? And he just gave it to us. And we were like, yeah, man, absolutely. Yes. Any piece of gear. And he goes, take good care of it and never get rid of it. That amp's been on stage with Skynyrd, and it's been in the studio twice with Jimi Hendrix.
Jeez.
So, yeah. So, like, I don't know. Maybe that's why the Skynyrd got me. Maybe it's just that song is just a...
Because it's legendary. Just an ass kicker.
It's a legendary song, man.
Skynyrd, it hits harder than Moon River. I'll tell you.
It does. That's why Moon River is the first song to like kind of like soft start you and give you your like, we're at a funeral moment. And then at the end, you know, you get... Everything's on fire. It's... I could watch... I did. I watched the funeral scene twice. I would watch it again right now. I might watch this whole movie again right now. I might, you know, just hit play on the beginning, make my popcorn...
Exactly.
Get my Coke all set
that
up.
That middle is the freaking sweet spot. Real, it's all good in there. From Chuck and Cindy all the way to like the memorial, the drive home. But then as soon as you get to the market, it's like everything goes to shit.
You don't like the end.
Oh my God.
Talk to me.
Okay.
What is it?
Everybody has on a red hat suddenly. And he's looking for someone in a red hat. And this is just like the worst costuming I've ever seen.
There are a lot of red hats. It didn't bug me that much. I was just so enchanted and in that it didn't bother me. But I see what you mean. There's like a whole crowd of people who are all in red hats, basically.
I wanted more explanation. Like, okay, or if we just end on a kiss, okay, great. Or show me like that they got together and they're living together, or like a scene of her with his family or something, because I can't picture them actually like what their life's gonna look like. But why with the fish and the salmon and the weird monologue at the end? I don't get it.
What is the last thing we see? I don't know exactly what I don't know
it's
exactly
some
what that
weird,
fish monologue was
like
about.
YouTube video ending. Like, it's just like flashes of random things. It's like a cell phone, planet Earth. Like, in conclusion, class, like, it's very weird. I'm just like, why are we ending the movie like this? I hate this so much. It dates it really badly. Ugh.
I did not feel as strongly about that as you did. I don't know. I think I was still in shock from how much I love the road trip. Yeah, and you know, like, and also, you know, there is that letdown moment where you don't think for a second that he's gonna find her, because there's a lot of red hats around, and she just doesn't seem to be there. This to me. Almost taking it back to Sofia Coppola again. This is the third Sofia Coppola movie we'll have mentioned in this episode, but almost like Lost in Translation, you know, the end of Lost in Translation, when you get the most important line in the movie and you don't hear what it is. It's just Bill Murray, you know, like murmuring into Scarlett Johansson's ear. And then that it just kind of like denouements out into silence after that. You get the two of them together. I liked that we didn't see beyond that moment because it...
Well, did you ever see A Waking Life?
Mm-mm.
Okay, that's a pretty good movie. It's like rotoscope, but...
I love rotoscope shit.
And it's really psychedelic. I'm surprised you haven't seen it, and like philosophical.
A Waking Life?
Mm-hmm. It's called Waking Life, sorry.
Who's in it? Or who directed
it? I don't know who directed it. The kid from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, I want to say, is in it. Or Dazed and Confused, I mean, that kid.
Oh, okay.
And it's all a bunch of like different artists, philosophers, scientists, and he's in a lucid dream. And he's like slowly meeting all these random dream characters until he realizes he's dreaming.
Okay.
It's crazy. I can't believe you haven't seen it.
Don't tell me anymore. I'll definitely check it out for sure.
It's old too, but there's this quote from it where this character, dream character, says, "The mission is to stay in a constant state of departure while always arriving." And it's just like a throwaway, but it's always stuck with me. And I feel like that pinpoints Claire's character. And that's where you get that feeling of like, is she even here? Is she going to show up? Like, it's very Virgin Suicides too. Like, is she going to show up? Is she real? Like, Kirsten Dunst has this way of being otherworldly. And maybe that is what brings the manic pixie dream girl, you know, trope into it for some people.
Yeah, she's...
And she's constantly traveling. They're constantly saying goodbye, hello. It's like we never really know if they're ever going to see each other again. It always could be the last time they see each other.
Well, in the street after the one-night stand, she's like, you got to stop trying to break up with me. We're not even together. And yeah. He goes, we're not? And she goes, no. And then she leaves. You're right. But like, I actually kind of like how rather than... Not to keep, I mean, I guess it is like the last movie that we watched. So it is the natural comparison and they are kind mm-hmm. of similar, but like in Garden State, when Natalie Portman and Zach Braff meet, they are locked together for the rest of the movie. They become each other's like obsession. In this movie, this is another argument for her not being a manic pixie dream girl. She's got shit going on. She has her own life to do. So they kind of, their two storylines kind of like dive in and out. They dive in and out of each other's life. They maintain contact, but it's almost like particles around an atom, you know, like they're drawn to each other for sure. And they recognize it and they bump off of each other from time to time and stick occasionally, but then break apart and back together. It's more reflective of real life and how things are and how relationships work. You know, like there isn't that sort of like toxic codependency that you see in, well, the movies that will bookend this one, because you kind of see toxic codependency in Eternal Sunshine too. So,
well, I mean, and we compare them, but it's everybody compared them. And what it is weird, like, what do you make of the fact that these movies are being made simultaneously and they both have the same storyline essentially of like the character has to go back home for a funeral because her parent died and they fall in love. It's like
I have a theory, but it's I might be just going way off base here, but we're looking at 2005 and Garden State is also 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
it's rumored Elizabethtown was in pre-production before Garden State, but I don't know if that's true.
I don't think these movies stole anything from each other. I think that these movies are an example of like zeitgeist, right? I think what we're looking at here is 2001, September 11 happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it takes the country. I still don't think we're all the way back from it. You know, like the world changed forever after that, especially America. We're mm-hmm. we're eternally different after that moment. The culture, social values, everything changed after that. And our mentality, the psyche of America was marred by that. So I think what happened is that those shockwaves reverberated, and then enough time passed after 9/11, after the Afghanistan war, and then the Iraq war starts, and everything's just fucked and chaos and heavy. But 2005 is just far enough away that I think you start to see artistic people trying to come to grips with what they're going through, what we're all going through, what the collective unconsciousness is experiencing. Because what are these movies about? These are about people who feel totally lost, alienated, and disconnected from the world. They feel like they're crumbling and falling apart. Zach Braff is numb and medicated and depressed, and Drew is suicidal. He feels like a failure. His whole world has fallen apart. And then they both go and confront the death of a loved one head on, the loss of something. And it's in both cases a father, right? No, it's a mother and a father. So they both go and confront something warm and nurturing, something comforting, maybe metaphorically an era that had come before. The 90s were like this warm, fuzzy golden age of skateboarding and Cartoon Network. You know, like it was the world felt different back then. Something like a childhood. And both of them kind of say goodbye to a parent and then have to rediscover what it means to live in the wake of that loss. So I don't know. I can kind of see people starting to come back from that stunned place that we all were, coming back from that moment of shock. And this is just two films. Maybe I'm like totally off base, but maybe this is two films, two people, two creative teams trying to come to terms with what's going on in the collective unconscious, or the zeitgeist in America, or to come to terms with what we'd all just been through. And this is the stories that come out of that. But maybe not.
I don't know. It is weird. I know that Cameron Crowe bases it off of his father dying, right? But, and I know it's like a common thing for, you know, you lose a parent, but then it is just weird to me that both of these movies come out the same year. It's like their plots are really similar.
This happens a lot, though. We talked about this it does, a little bit yeah, in the Garden State episode, but like Armageddon and Deep Impact, you know, Dante's Peak and Volcano. There's a lot of, for whatever reason, a lot of movies come out in twos. And also, this just might be a Hollywood thing. Like, maybe scripts are circulating. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, maybe, I know a lot of times if a movie hits, other studios will be like, what do we have for blah? Like, when in horror, you see this happen where, like, a demon possession movie will pop off, and then like the later that year or like the next year, you get like three more from three different studios. I think a lot of studios have scripts in reserve. I know these two movies were not that case, but that's kind of how you get like the knockoffs is, where's our, you know, like, oh my God, Jaws is a hit. Where's our shark picture? And they're like, we got it right here, Bill. We've been holding on to it for 3 years, you know, bought the rights ages ago. 'Cause you never know when a shark is going to trend. But
I just can't imagine how bizarre it would be to be on either side of these movies and be like, oh, there's a whole nother group of people in production doing the exact same movie we are. Great.
Not
fan fucking tastic.
It's not. I think that the comparisons between these movies are actually fairly surface level.
Yeah, for sure.
Because when you watch the two of them, you can't, as far as like quality goes and tone is the big one. Vibe, even the aim, like the actual like aim of the films are totally different. The basic plots are kind of similar. The here's the similarities. Two guys, both characters, like Drew and Zach Braff, their lives fall apart, go back home to the funeral. When they're back home, they reconnect with small town life, although Drew is not from there. He doesn't remember that small town life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like,
so as he's not going back home, he's going to kind of a foreign place that's foreign to him. But they reconnect with a simpler form of life through an interaction with a girl that they meet. But this is just basically like the funerals make it the weird parallel. But otherwise, these are just romance films. Guy hits hard time. I mean, The Holiday is kind of this movie without the funeral. You know,
could you imagine Ashton Kutcher in this movie?
I can't.
He's so bad.
It would be fucking terrible. We wouldn't be having the same conversation for sure. I honestly think that you definitely can't change Kirsten Dunst. I don't know if I would recast this. I have trouble imagining other people in this.
You can't have Kirsten Dunst with Ashton Kutcher. Like, she would just be so much better than him. It would be insane. Like,
it would be offensive.
Yeah, there's no way that would ever work.
She's so good in this. She's great in this. I even like her in Spider-Man. Like, that first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, that movie slaps. I don't care what anybody says. It's so good.
I don't know if I don't like Orlando Bloom or if I just don't like his character. But yeah, I mean,
if you watch nothing else, you and your kids should sit down and watch Pirates of the Caribbean, at least the first one. That first one, The Curse of the Black Pearl, is so good. Johnny Depp, love him or hate him as a person, as an actor, especially in that movie, very talented. His performance is captivating. Keira Knightley is fucking awesome. Jeffrey Rush is incredible. Jeffrey Rush is like icon status in that movie. And Orlando Bloom is great. There's that we, like I said, Bird and I, as 33 and 34 year old adults, just watched it again like last week. I would watch it again tonight. If like if you lived closer, I'd be like, Cassandra, just come over. We're gonna watch Pirates of the Caribbean, okay? So yeah, check it out. That one's good. I'm gonna go deeper on Orlando Bloom. I was trying to think of other movies that he's been in, but I honestly can't think of any. Like Lord of the Rings, Troy, the first two or three Pirates of the Caribbean movies, this, and I mean, I know he's been in stuff, but those are kind of my touchstones for him. I love
trying to picture Ryan Gosling in this movie. It does not work.
Maybe back then, though. You know who could have, you know who maybe could have pulled this off is Josh Hartnett, but I think he was, I think Josh Hartnett could have done it.
No, there is something about like the quality of the actors. That's where it's so disappointing with the writing. It's like, okay, just the beginning and just the end. If you would have cleaned it up a little bit.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Okay. This could have been a great film.
I talked a lot of love on this movie. I barely shit talked at the beginning. I guess let me shit talk it just a tiny little bit more. The scene where Judy Greer and Orlando Bloom and Susan Sarandon are walking through that airport.
Oh, God.
Is one of the stiffest bits of acting I've ever mm-hmm. seen. The dialogue is not good. No, I'm being too kind. Let me like get into it. The dialogue is trash, and they're all like wooden stiff puppet people deliveries. It is really fucking bad, and it happens early in the movie. So when I first, and remember, I came into this having heard from everyone that it sucked and like it was one of the worst movies ever. Actually, there's an article somewhere online called In Search of the Worst Film Ever Made, and Elizabethtown is the picture at the top. So and I was like, fuck, I have to watch this stupid thing. And then that scene is like in the first 10 minutes.
So
and
bad.
He told me it was bad after telling me it was great. And I'm like, shit, but luckily that is not how it played out.
Well, it's sad because like it's not Susan Sarandon's fault, and
it's
she's
not.
Great, but this is not how you use Susan Sarandon.
No, I like half of her stuff. I don't like that in that three-way phone call part where she like is like in the background learning how to organic cook, and she's gonna learn to tap dance, and Judy Greer's like, you have to come home. I'm like, I hate them. I hope they do not come back in the rest of this movie, which made me sad because I like both of those actors a lot.
Like, I see why he wants to kill himself.
Yeah, dude, that his family's kind of a lot. But once they're in Elizabethtown, it changes. I love Susan Sarandon's eulogy. I think it's great.
Yes. That all
even
works.
The tap dancing. I even like the tap dancing. I know you don't dig it, but like it works.
No, really. I like it. I just know, you know, how people feel online. There was one letterbox review
are
that was
worst reviews of worst versions of themselves online, though. Remember,
I know there was one letterbox review that was like, I am one of the three people that like this movie. The other two movie people have been put into witness protection. Like, exactly. It feels dangerous to like this movie publicly.
Oh, dude. You know what? I think I'm bulletproof at this point, though, because I just talked for like 2 hours the other day about how much I fucking love Twilight. I think I'm untouchable at this point, man. I'm just like, Twilight's fucking awesome.
Right. Did you ever read The Host?
The Host. Is that the Guillermo del Toro movie?
It's a book by the same woman who wrote the Twilight books, but it's sci-fi.
No, I did not. Is it good?
You might like it. I thought it was okay. Like, I thought it was good, but
did
I'm not.
Did you read any of the Twilight books?
Yeah. I mean, I've read all of them, unfortunately, multiple times.
What are your thoughts on them? Because, like, Bird read them, and I know what she thinks of them, so I'm going to try and gauge. It's called, what's it called? The Host by Stephanie Meyer?
Yeah.
I might give it a pop.
Feel like an old woman's creepy melatonin suppressed Mormon fever dream fantasy world for sure, but also like if it's like fall but it doesn't get cold enough here and like I want to feel sad, I'll listen to some Twilight and it'll help like bring on all of like the you know, it's got a lot of vibes going on, but it is definitely toxic. Like when I listen to it now for when I did like a review of them.
Yeah. Like the audiobooks?
Yeah, I listen to them now compared to like when they first came out or like back when I had first listened to them. And I'm like, wow, this is toxic and bad. Like, this is really bad.
The movies are no better. They're fucking unbelievably toxic.
Oh, just wait. It gets worse. Like,
no spoilers. I'm going in totally clean.
But by the end, you're going to be like, I need a shower. Like, that's who do we call? Do we call the police? Like, I don't know what to do. Like, it's bad. But there is something about the writing, or she describes, there's this one scene where Bella sits in a chair and she like watches the seasons pass from her bedroom window. And there's lots of scenes where I feel like she writes Bella's character feeling so isolated very well. And
Connor has mentioned that scene in the past. He says it, I think it's in the next movie. I think it's in New Moon. Is that the second one?
Yeah, I think so.
And then it's Breaking Dawn Part 1 and 2. Yeah, so anyway, in the second Twilight movie, that scene that you just described is shot, apparently. And Connor says he's never seen a better depiction of depression on screen ever in his life. So, I mean, I don't know. If you guys are curious, head on. Actually, right now, it's not paywalled. So I just put it down so that Connor could listen to it. I was going to put the paywall back up, but here's what I'll do. After this episode drops, it'll still be April. Until April 30th, I will leave the first two Chucky Gets Sucky episodes on patreon.com/quillenfilm unpaywalled. So if you guys want to go and check out my opinions of Twilight for the next month, you can do it for free. And then I'll pop that paywall back up. But yeah.
Yes.
You can hear me just like gush about Twilight. It's not that I thought it was a good movie necessarily. I just had so much fun watching it with Connor and my wife that
the cinematography quality is going to drop majorly. A change, I'll say. Like, you don't get any of that cool, like, the whole first movie has a vibe, like a tone, like a very distinct, like, indie film tone.
It does. It feels like it almost feels like what you did I Know What You Did Last Summer or something, but with a little bit more like CG and vampires. Dude, Supermassive Black Hole during the baseball game, love it or hate it, that's a whole feel for sure.
One cool thing about the Twilight movies though is that even though they were making a ton of money, they were turning them around as quickly as they could. So these movies were rushed. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's kind of good in a way, because the actors actually had to work. Well, you'll get to it. There are some points where I'm like, are we just Weekend at Bernie-ing it? Like, what's going on here with... what's his name? Kristen Stewart, Edward Pattinson, Robert Pattinson. Yeah. He's like so fucking high on heroin.
Dude,
through some of these movies, I'm just like, Rosie, okay. Like, what?
This is one of my favorite things when I talk to Connor. And I, like I said, I've only seen the first film at this point. And I watched it under the best possible circumstances, laughing my ass off with Connor and Bird. But one of my favorite things about the Twilight movies is knowing that those two lead actors who are bad, I won't even say terrible, because there's some shit in Twilight that I like, because they're making real choices in that first movie. They're actually like making choices and sticking to them and committing.
Oh, they are acting their asses off.
They're acting
off.
But sometimes they're, mm-hmm. sometimes the way they're acting is just like, I'm dead inside and nothing touches me. And you're like, you're so flat. I can't even, it's almost like impressive how flat some of it can be. But anyway, I love knowing that what I'm watching, those two actors are going to go on to be two of the best fucking actors.
Right. It's mind today. Blowing.
Mind blowing. That, like, seeing Kristen Stewart, you're like, she will, you have to almost remind yourself, like, in just like 5 or 6 years or 10 years, she will be one of the best actresses alive. And Robert Pattinson's about to go and do The Lighthouse and the best Batman film ever made.
I would say, yeah, Robert Pattinson is amazing, because I watched The Lighthouse because of your podcast and I loved it. But Kristen Stewart, like, once you get through these movies, you're going to be like, oh, so she just does that thing. She just goes, like, that's all she does. It's really annoying, and she cannot act. She's no Princess Di.
You should check out On the Road. You should watch On the Road with Kristen. Okay. Kristen Stewart's in that. It's an adaptation.
Oh, no. Yes, I've seen On the Road. Yeah, and she is great in that movie.
We did. Yeah. We just did Underwater for the podcast as well. And honestly, Underwater is a lot of fun, too. It is definitely like Anxiety the movie. I've seen it 3 times now. Like, I watched it with Bird's parents and Bird. Then Bird and I watched it. And then me and Connor watched it. And like, basically, they're at the bottom of the ocean in a drilling, like a big, like, underwater mining operation. And shit starts to go wrong, and they're cut off from the surface, and water is flooding in all over the place, and they have to walk across the bottom of the ocean floor in suits that were not designed to be out for more than, like, 10 minutes for, like, an hour and a half, and then they find out that maybe they're not alone at the bottom of the ocean. It really is a hard watch. You're just like, the whole time you're like, please God, get back inside. Oh my God, what was that over there? Oh my, it's just like the whole time you just want to be on a sedative. It's so fucking anxiety inducing, but it's really good. And she's great in it. All right. It's 11:47. I got to go tomorrow and bring my car into the mechanic. So do you have any final thoughts on Elizabethtown? I recommend it strongly. I'll watch this movie again. For sure.
Right.
I don't know if I'd buy it, but I would rent it for sure.
I love it. I bought it. I've seen it 100 times. I was surprised, like, when I rewatched it for this, I was going through so much personal drama and bullshit. And like, I just turned off everything. And I was like, I'm not looking at social media. I'm just going to watch this movie. And it was a total escape for me. And it made me feel so much better. And like, it was so comforting and charming. And I just loved it.
Yeah. I was so ready to hate everything about it. And I thought I was going to for the first quarter, maybe. And then the all-night phone call happened, and I just fell in love. And I'm an Elizabethtown fan, man. I like this. I recommended it to my family. I went on Snapchat and was like, you guys need a date night movie? Check this sucker out. Get through the bumpy beginning and the end. It goes hard after that. This movie's awesome.
And if you're not like a film nerd, I don't think you would even, the beginning wouldn't even bother you. You know what I mean? I think this is kind of par for the course. Like, and also there's an alternate ending. That was cut, but it's just that like some girl in the Midwest while Drew was traveling across country found out that if you cut off the side of the shoe fin, it'll make a whistling sound and makes it the perfect shoe. So like it gives it new life. I don't know. It's again, like, where do they live? Whose house are they moving to? You know what I mean? Are they together forever now? Is it long distance? I just need details.
You're after the hot goss at the end of this thing. I'm just like, and you know, you know what it is? It's death and life, man. Because he just got done with the funeral. And now this is the first moment of whatever happens next. But we know that something else happens next. That's all I need. Can you imagine if they made an Elizabethtown 2 where they're like, and this is them going grocery shopping and here's them are like having to deal with the rent. I'm like, nah, I'm good with this.
Right. We'll just keep the salmon. That's fine.
Yeah, I'd rather have the YouTube ending than like a sequel or too much more. Or they give you like the scrolling text at the end and they're like, and they moved into a small brownstone apartment in 2017. Yeah. And
anyway. Right. Honestly, she's too good for him. Jessica Biel is always a surprise in this movie. And Alec Baldwin. So funny.
I was not expecting to see Alec Baldwin. I don't know why, but I was not expecting him to be that good either. I'm like, he's going to just phone it in. But then it's fucking Alec Baldwin, dude. He kills it. He is so good. He's at his best when he's playing like kind of patronizing douchebags. And I don't know the man, but you almost get the sense that he's Robert Downey Jr.ing it a little bit, and that's just kind of who he is, a little touch. So he's bringing that to it, but he's so fucking talented, it's unbelievable.
Which, again, I just want to put in an official request that you guys watch A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints.
A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints. I'll add it right under Waking Life. Have you seen Glengarry Glen Ross?
No.
You're shitting me.
No.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, hold on.
I didn't even know the difference between Russell Cameron and Russell Crowe. To me, they could be the same person.
It's Cameron like, Crowe. Russell Crowe.
Whatever. Everybody's like Almost Famous. Like everybody like worships at the altar of that film. Like it was okay.
Oh, you're out of your mind. Almost Famous is fucking awesome. One of Philip Seymour Hoffman's best. Dude, I Am a Golden God is like part of the patois of me and my brother's entire lives. That's what the only reason I like Tiny Dancer is that song. I didn't give a shit about Elton John at all until the Tiny Dancer scene. And anyway, I like Almost Famous quite a lot. You need to watch Glengarry Glen Ross. That movie's amazing. Okay. It's got Alec Baldwin. The big one that everyone remembers is Alec Baldwin for his Coffee is for Closers monologue.
Okay, but I do remember this.
Al Pacino is in this one too. And this is like peak pissed off Pacino when he's like going so fucking apeshit that he's gonna have a coronary. That this is that movie, dude. And it's written by I've totally spaced on his name. David Mamet. David Mamet wrote the play. It's initially a stage play, and they adapted it to film. And it's pretty late, and I'm kind of tired, so I can't remember for 100% sure, but I'm like 90% sure that David Mamet also wrote the screenplay. It's fucking awesome. They might just straight up do the play, but holy shit, is it a good movie. It's unbelievable. I had to watch it in college, and then after that, I was like, oh, this is a banger, and I show it to people all the time. Glengarry Glen Ross, listener, if you haven't checked it out, very good. It's about salespeople.
I love it. Somehow captivating. I love telemarketing sales movies. There was one with Vince Vaughn in the 90s that's like disappeared from the internet that I loved. All of them.
We just watched an episode of X-Files. It's season 5, episode 19, I think. It's about a dude who works for like a telemarketing company works at a call center trying to sell siding. And he realizes that his boss is like a soul-sucking monster that can disguise itself as like upper management, normal human being. And when he comes into contact with like the regular working class Joes, he sucks their souls out and turns them into zombies by using a neurotoxin. Anybody who hasn't watched X-Files, you need to watch that whole series like right now, dude. X-Files is one of the best shows ever made. So fucking
it's so good.
Ugh. Anyway, that's all I've got for now. The next one is Eternal Sunshine.
Yes, which I'm excited to rewatch because I haven't seen it in years and years and years. I remember hating it.
Okay.
But maybe I'll rewatch it and like it.
All right. I haven't seen it since season 1 of Measuring Flicks. So this is season
1. But you guys loved it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to love. And we'll get into it. I will approach it as I've approached these two through the lens of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, kind of focus on the characters and such. The episode's up on Spotify if you guys want to hear what I thought 4 years ago or 5 years ago about like the whole film. But maybe I'll check that out too to like kind of remind myself what I've already talked about so I'm not like repeating myself over and over. But yeah, I want to come at it specifically to talk about the treatment of the writing and like approach to that character, because one thing I do remember clearly is I loved everything about that movie except Kate Winslet's character. She's just unbearable. And guess who's in that movie and is awesome? Kirsten Dunst.
Right.
Dude, a double header of Kirsten Dunst excellence. I'm fucking so excited. All right. I got to get out of here. I got to get some sleep. So, everybody, thank you so much for listening. Cassandra, I did all my top matter up top. Do you want to send them anywhere? Do any pluggables?
Yeah, just come follow me on Cassandra Explains It All or Drenched in Drama. Patreon, Apple, Spotify, Instagram, pretty much everywhere.
Awesome. And stay tuned next week. Not probably not next week, actually. I have a big, crazy, busy weekend. But sometime soon, check back and we'll continue our deep dive into the murky depths of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
And I forgot to tell you, I ended up interviewing the producer of the She Was Here documentary.
Oh, shit.
About Heather O'Rourke, right? So we should do Poltergeist sometime soon.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I am totally cool to like slide Poltergeist in as like the break in the middle of Manic Pixie Dream Girl. I love Poltergeist. I talk about that movie anytime. Okay, cool. You did an interview. Is that up anywhere or will be soon?
It's on my Patreon. I can just email it to you.
Okay. Yeah. I would love to check that out and go and check out Cassandra's Patreon, because you interview famous people all the time. I'm too nervous to do that. I just like to chat with my friends about movies. That's my vibe. All right.
I try.
Until next time, y'all. Thank you so much for listening, and good night.